Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we have an interview with AFSCME Union Public Affairs Coordinator, Larry Dorman. And I'm trying, I don't know why, but my computer seems to not be connecting here tonight. But we're going to continue regardless. Like something is on continued slow-mo here. Unbelievable. What's going on? Don't know. Don't understand this at all. All right. I have to try that one again. Anyway, I'm sorry for the technical difficulties here. We have an interview coming up with Larry Dorman. I'm going to go to that in a little while. I'm just hoping that I can, here we go. Finally, we got the Blog Talk Radio. Some reason I can't get to my switchboard. We're trying, but I have an interesting article tonight. I got a couple interesting articles actually that I wanted to talk about before we go to the interview. Hold on 1 second. There we go. Finally in. It's always good to be successful. And tonight we're going to, I want to start tonight's show with an article I picked up from globalresearch.ca. It says, routine massacre of civilians in Iraq. Former GIs describe U.S. policy of firing on civilians. Now, you know, we've had a tremendous problem over there, and I, you know, we still are. And oh yeah, they're thinking of getting out. Yeah, they're withdrawing their troops in the next year, all right, which may not happen. It all looks good for the great white craziness. But we're going to try. So if you can hang on 1 second. There you go. Our first article tonight is called The Routine Massacre of Civilians in Iraq. Three former U.S. soldiers involved in the infamous collateral murder helicopter gunship attack on Baghdad civilians in July 2007 say that attack was nothing out of the ordinary. The massacre that killed more than a dozen Iraqis, two of them employed by Reuters, ignited a wave of international revulsion against the U.S. military in Iraq when a video of the massacre was released by WikiLeaks last April. I gotta hand it to WikiLeaks. I don't know how they're getting this information, but, it's probably a good thing that they are. What the world did not see in the months of training that led up to the incident, in which soldiers were taught to respond to threats with a barrage of fire, a wall of steel, in Army parlance, even if it put civilians at risk, and report Sarah Lazar and Ryan Harvey in the August 16th issue of The Nation magazine. Former Army Specialist Josh Stiber said that newly arrived soldiers in Baghdad were asked if they would fire back at an attacker if they knew armed civilians might get hurt in the process. Those who did not respond affirmatively or who hesitated were knocked around until they realized what was expected of them, added former Army Specialist Ray Corcoles, who deployed with Stiber. A third former Army Specialist, Ethan McCord, said his battalion commander gave orders to shoot indiscriminately after attacks by improvised explosive devices. Anytime someone in your line gets hit by an IED, you kill every motherfucker in the street. McCord quotes him as saying. Carcoles told the reporters he purposely turned his gun away from people. You don't even know if somebody's shooting at you. It's just insanity to start shooting people. From our own experiences and the experiences of other veterans we have talked to, we know that the acts depicted in this video are everyday occurrences of this war. This is the nature of how U.S.-led wars are carried out in this region, said McCord and Stiver in the open letter to the Iraqis who were injured in the July attack. Together with Carcoles, they were decided to go public about the true nature of the war. McCord was shown in the video rushing the wounded children from a van. For this humanitarian act, he was threatened and mocked by his commanding officer, said the Nation reporters, and his platoon leaders also yelled at him to quit worrying about those motherfucking kids. McCord told the reporter of multiple instances in which soldiers abused detainees or beat people up in their houses. In one case, he says someone was taken from his house, beaten up, and then left on the side of the road, bloodied and still handcuffed, Lazar and Harvey write. The veterans say they support the release of the video and Akbar documents by WikiLeaks because it confronts people globally with the realities of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Army intelligence analyst Bradley Manning, accused of leaking the video to WikiLeaks, is facing Espionage Act charges and has been transferred to Kuwait for a military trial. Lazar and Harvey note, the government is also probing where WikiLeaks got the 90,000 secret U.S. military documents from Afghanistan it released last month. These reports, according to The Nation, detail the role of U.S. assassination teams, widespread civilian casualties resulting from U.S. attacks, and staggering Afghan government incompetence and corruption. The totalitarian mantle of secrecy by which the Pentagon shrouds its war crimes makes the disclosure by intelligence analyst Manning appear all the more courageous. As long as the Pentagon keeps him behind bars, every American who believes in the biblical injunction that the truth shall make ye free is also a prisoner of that same tyranny. And the three former Army specialists who told their story to The Nation have given us a good idea of what it is the Pentagon doesn't want the American people to know. And that's from the globalresearch.ca. A very credible operation. My next article tonight is from Press TV, which is the Iranian press, actually. It's called Venezuela Ready to Sell Petrol to Iran. The Venezuelan ambassador to Tehran said his country is ready to sell gasoline to Iran despite U.S. and EU unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Every time Tehran announces this demand, we will provide it with gasoline, David Velasquez Carabello told FARS news agency on Monday. Carabello added that the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has announced Caracas' readiness to provide Tehran with gasoline. In September 2009, Hugo Chavez said that his country is to provide Tehran with 20,000 barrels of gasoline per day. Chavez made the announcement at a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, in Tehran. Following a July 9th UN Security Council sanction against Iran, the U.S. and European Union took unilateral measures against the country over its nuclear program. To force Tehran to halt its peaceful nuclear activities, the U.S. has decided to put pressure on companies selling gasoline to Iran. The new restriction comes as Turkey also announced that it would support Turkish companies in exporting gasoline to Iran, despite the sanctions. If the preference of the private sector is to sell these petroleum products to Iran, we will help them, Turkey's energy and natural resource minister told Reuters on Wednesday. The Turkish official made the remark as Russian oil giant Lukoil has resumed gasoline sales to Iran in partnership with China's state-run firm Zhuhai Zhenrong. So there's definitely an opposition here, and I'm sorry, I cannot support sanctions against Iran, nor can I support sanctions against any country. But that you know, Iran has done absolutely nothing, all right, to warrant our aggression, other than being, enemies with Israel, which is every country in the world is an enemy with Israel except the United States, you know, and we're the country who should be enemies with Israel. I mean, that was the kind of crap that they pull. But, that doesn't seem to be happening. But I go on record as stating that I support them. I support the Israel, I support what that article stated, that people should look seriously at the Iranian issue. And Iran does not pose any real threat to the United States. So let's get on with it. This is one that bothers me quite a bit, this article. And there's two articles I'd like to bring up tonight. One is the about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the other is this one. Democrats may use food stamp money to pay for Michelle Obama's nutrition initiative. Democrats will reluctantly slash the food stamp program to fund a state aid bill may have to do so again to pay for a top priority of the First Lady Michelle Obama. I mean, I gotta ask. I mean, where the hell does she get off doing anything? I mean, she's just the wife of the president. You know what I mean? I mean, why does she have any authority whatsoever in any of these issues? I fail to understand that. But especially in such a critical bill. The House will soon consider an $8 billion child nutrition bill that's at the center of the First Lady's Let's Move initiative. Now, you know, my first reaction is to say, you know, up yours, lady, First Lady. I mean, she's got a butt the size of a barn. I mean, you know, why don't you consider your own health there, you know, and stop eating, the junk food you do. Instead of worrying, you're going to take away billions of dollars away from people who deserve it to throw 6 cents more. Well, this article explains it, but, you know, it's totally irrelevant, you know, to anything that this First Lady has any say in such an important bill. I mean, she's totally irrelevant. I mean, she's just a total irrelevance. Just as Obama's becoming an irrelevance, but, you know, the First Lady, come on, you know. The House will soon consider an $8 billion child nutrition bill that at the center of the First Lady's Let's Move initiative. Before leaving for the summer recess, the Senate passed a smaller version of the legislation that is paid for by trimming the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as the Food Stamp Program. The proposed cuts would come on top of a 13.6% food stamp reduction in the $26 billion Medicaid and education state funding bill that President Obama signed this week. I thought this bastard was supposed to be a compassionate liberal, all right? This guy's nothing more than, he's worse than goddamn Bush, all right? And, you know, he makes you sick. This bastard makes you sick. And now his fat-ass wife is involved with this thing as well. I mean, come on, you know, who's directing what? And the Democrats are what, you know, sitting there on their knees, with their hands out? I mean, what's going on here? It doesn't make any sense. Food stamps have made multiple appearances on the fiscal chopping block because Democrats have few other places to turn to offset the cost of legislation. Well, forget it. Party leaders raided the budget to find offsetting tax increases and spending cuts to pay for their top legislative priorities, including the roughly $900 billion health care law, right, which was totally insane, right? And the congressional pay-as-you-go rules require lawmakers to offset all non-emergency spending. Well, Democrats have turned to the food stamp program because funding increases enacted in the stimulus package last year were already scheduled to phase out over time. I mean, you know, people are starving out there. People are starving. You got a 20% unemployment rate. I mean, this is insanity, all right? And, you know, the changes proposed in the state aid and nutrition bills would simply cut off the increase early in March 2014 because the cuts would not take effect for more than 3 years. But Democratic leaders have voiced the hope that they will be able to stop the cuts in future legislation. But House liberals are balking now because saying that while they swallowed the food stamp cuts to pay for the urgent funding for Medicaid and teachers, they will not vote for more cuts in child nutrition bill. In a letter sent this week to Speaker Nancy Pelosi, 101 House Democrats urged the Speaker to take the House version of the child nutrition bill, which does not slash food stamps, rather than the Senate version. This is one of the more egregious cases of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and is a vote we do not take lightly, the lawmakers led by Representative James McGovern, a Democrat from Mass, and Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota, said of their vote on the state aid bill. The House version of the child nutrition bill, authored by Representative George Miller, a Democrat from California, passed the Education and Labor Committee earlier this year. But lawmakers must find a way to pay for it before it comes to the floor for a vote. Chairman Miller is working to find other ways to pay for the bill, a spokesman said when asked if cuts to the food stamp program would be used. A House leadership aide noted that the food stamp decrease approved in the state aid bill will not take effect right away and will leave the program at the same funding level it was at before the stimulus law was signed. That doesn't mean many Democrats are not concerned about the issue, but this is a process which gives us time to deal with immediate issues, like jobs, and helps the economy grow while giving you time to deal with the food stamp issue. The nutrition bill is clearly a priority for Michelle Obama, who has made a push for healthy eating, one of her signature policy issues at the White House. When the House version of the nutrition bill won committee approval in July, it marked the first time she weighed in publicly on pending legislation. And I think this is wrong. I think this is terribly wrong. And I think she's a total irrelevant piece of work and should be, you know, not even considered. Okay? But the Obama administration has not directly addressed the debate over the food stamp cuts, but it's backing the Senate bill. We strongly supported the Senate action and look forward to working with the House to get a final bill onto the president's desk, an administration official told The Hill. A $4.5 billion Senate bill would expand eligibility for food meal programs, establish nutrition standards for all food sold in schools, and provide a 6-cent increase. 6 cents. Okay, increase for each school lunch, for each cafeteria serve healthier meals. You know that 6-cent increase is going to go into the pockets of some administration or some, you know, or the school or something. Okay, it's not going to go to meals. I mean, give me a break. It's just not going to happen. Okay, and the $8 billion House version, including more money for expanding access to school lunches for children in low-income households. The deeper food stamp reductions in the Senate version would set an earlier date in November 2013 for eliminating the increased benefits passed last year. A family of four would see their benefits reduced by $59 a month, or about 9%. And the bill would allow cut funding for nutrition educational programs aimed at low-income neighborhoods and households. And, you know, people that are taking food stamps are below the poverty line now. They can't afford the food. Okay, they can't afford food. They go in, you get, you know, your food stamps. Now they're going to cut $59 a month. I mean, that's tremendous amount of money for somebody on the edge of somebody in poverty, all right, for food, and what are they going to do? I mean, you know, I mean that's $10 or so a month or more, $12 a month, $12 a week, all right. So you know, it's a lot of money when you're looking at a few, you know, at a box of cereal or a, you know, some a loaf of bread, you know, at $3 a loaf or, you know. I mean, a lot of people are going to be hurting here. And the bill would also cut funding for nutrition education programs. I mean, they want to increase food at 6 cents a meal, all right, for school lunches, but then they want to reduce nutrition education programs aimed at low-income households. I mean, it's insane. And it's very sad. I think it's just illustrating what dire straits, and this is what this guy said, as dire straits our federal government budget is in. This is Sheila Zalewski, Director of Urban Institute's Income and Benefit Policy Center. It's unprecedented to raid one safety net program to feed another. And I agree with it 100%. And to allow Mrs. Obama, okay, to have any say whatsoever in legislation, is totally, absolutely absurd. It's absurd, right? And she's absurd. The whole system's absurd. Okay, for her to have any relevance whatsoever. It makes you sick. It makes you sick. I got a couple more, one or two more articles before I give up the ghost here. To the interview, last night's interview. I think it's important to note this is an important article that needs to be read and should be, you know. This is by the Examiner, right? And by Tom Fitton, F-I-T-T-O-N, op-ed contributor, dated August 15th. Why is Washington ignoring its biggest corruption scandal? Too few in Washington have been digging into the scandals behind the collapse of the government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and their role in helping trigger the global financial crisis. Their collapse has cost taxpayers $146 billion thus far. Freddie Mac sought an additional $1.8 billion in taxpayer support just last week. There is no end in sight, as the Obama administration, through executive fiat, has placed no upper limit on the taxpayer liability to these two monstrosities. One reason official Washington isn't too interested in Fannie Mae and Freddie is the role political corruption played in their collapse in 2008. That's why Judicial Watch filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Obama administration requesting documents related to campaign contributions made by Fannie and Freddie over the last several election cycles. We figure since the American taxpayers are on the hook for trillions of dollars, potentially including nearly $1 trillion alone for Fannie and Freddie, we deserve to know how and why this financial collapse occurred and who in Washington, D.C. is responsible. The transparent Obama administration, and transparent in quotes, disagrees. The Federal Housing Finance Agency, the agency responsible for Freddie and Fannie Mae, responded to our Freedom of Information lawsuit by telling us that all of the documents we seek are not Freedom of Information able. Here's the exact language the Obama agency used in court filing. Any records created by or held in the custody of the enterprises reflecting their political campaign contributions or policies, stipulations, and requirements concerning campaign contributions necessarily are private corporate documents. They are not agency records subject to disclosure under FOIA. That's bullshit because these are federal agencies. You and I are paying the tab for the collapse of Fannie and Freddie. but we are not allowed to ask any questions about why it happened. The Obama administration is saying, in effect, none of your business. This whole scandal blows out of the water any notion that Obama is keeping his promises of transparency. I don't see anything ambiguous about the government's relationship with Fannie and Freddie. The two agencies are now completely owned and operated by the federal government and are therefore subject to freedom of information law. Now let's stop and think for a second. Why would the Obama administration be so intent on keeping records related to Fannie and Freddie campaign contributions secret? Well, take a look at the list of the top recipients of the Fannie and Freddie campaign contributions from 1989 through 2008. I think you have a pretty good idea. Obama is second on the list, sandwiched between Democratic heavyweights Chris Dodd and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. The president rocketed to the near top of the chart with only 4 years under his belt in the U.S. Senate. So, I mean, there's absolute collusion here. And the truth is, no one in Washington wants the American people to know all the sordid details regarding Fannie and Freddie, Obama included. The list of recipients of Fannie and Freddie cash includes a lot of R's and D's, in other words, Republicans and Democrats. It seems politicians of every stripe were on the take from Fannie and Freddie, and now we're all paying for it, literally. Separately, we uncovered documents showing that Congress was made aware of the massive problems of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac over the last 6 years. Yet liberals, led by Republican Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, another beneficiary of Fannie and Freddie campaign cash, largesse, and chairman of the House Committee on Financial Services, repeatedly blocked attempts to rein in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. On groundbreaking legal effort to open up Fannie and Freddie is not just about political corruption, it's also about accountability. Largely through Freddie and Fannie, the Obama administration has taken control of the U.S. mortgage market and its attendant liabilities, which means you, I, our children, and grandchildren are potentially on the hook for trillions of dollars. This unprecedented takeover of the private sector is being done by government entities that the Obama administration says are not subject to any open records requests. Let's hope, for the sake of accountable government, that the court disagrees. And you can check this out on Tom Fitton, as president of the Judicial Watch, Inc., judicialwatch.org. And very, very good article. It's about time to go to our interview. I don't know if I have anything else I want to import now. Well, there's a lot of important stuff, but this last one I'm going to go to briefly, but it's rather important. Obama mortgages the Gulf of Mexico to BP. In a deal that has sweeping long-term implications for millions of people living and working along the Gulf Coast, the Obama administration has agreed to base the payments by BP to the Oil Disaster Fund on the oil giant's profits from its drilling operation in the Gulf. Rather than get the cash up front, they're making some kind of deal here, all right, that BP is going to pay them on the profits, okay, from their oil wells in the Gulf. And rather than to continue operating in the Gulf. On Monday, BP made its first deposit in the disaster fund, which is overseen by claims czar Kenneth Feinberg, while top executives visit the White House to discuss the longer-term financial commitment. The initial sum was $3 billion, with another $2 billion to be paid during the fourth quarter of 2010, which is in December. I mean, thereafter, BP will deposit $1.25 billion each quarter for the next 3 years, all right, bringing the total up to its original pledge of $20 billion. The company's CEO, Robert Dudley, and Lamar Gauthier, a top executive for the BP, met Monday at the White House with Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel and retired Admiral Thad Allen, who headed the government disaster, and other administration officials. White House statement declared that the Obama aides impressed upon BP the importance of living up to their commitment, but underscored the administration will remain vigilant in ensuring the promises met, Yeah, right. Bullshit. And then they allow them this deal. The actual nature of Obama BP talks, however, is better demonstrated by the 40-page agreement, whose text was released by the White House late Wednesday afternoon. After the first $3 billion into the fund, BP must provide collateral to guarantee the remaining $17 billion and a pledge to deposit over the next 3.5 years. It's going to take them 3.5 years, folks, to come up with that $20 billion. You know, BP initially claimed that no such collateral was necessary because it will be able to make the payments from operating cash flow. Well, seize the goddamn cash flow. Seize the money now and get the money in the bank now to pay off these poor people in the Gulf. BP will give us as security interest in production payments pertaining to the company's U.S. oil and natural gas production, the bulk of which is located in the Gulf of Mexico. So this ensures that there's no stoppage of work by BP and that they can continue to go on and soak up and screw up the oil, and screw up the Gulf Coast for the next 3 years, right? Because the payments to the people in the Gulf Coast are dependent on their pumping oil out of the Gulf Coast. I mean, it's absurd how these sons of bitches can actually get away with doing this, all right? It's just an absurdity. So, you know, the article made me absolutely sick, but what you can do is you can go to it. It's on a Uruknet, URUKNET, right? .de Kelowna. I got it at Uruknet. Yeah, you might want to try that. But it's by Patrick Martin, written August 12th, 2010. But I mean, it's just, if you want to get hoodwinked, I mean, it's unbelievable. So the consumer lobby Public Citizen took note that the same fact, its director Tyson Solcom said in a statement that securing the compensation fund with drilling revenue is widely inappropriate, as it is, it will make the government and BP virtual partners in the Gulf oil production. It will give the government a financial incentive to become an even bigger booster of offshore drilling in the Gulf. And BP operates 89 producing wells in the Gulf of Mexico and owns a stake in 60 Gulf wells operated by other oil companies. The combined BP production for all 149 wells is about 400,000 barrels a day, worth $32 million a day, or $11.6 billion a year. At a market price of $80 a barrel, the Gulf accounts for 10% of BP's worldwide production, which is peanuts. Anyway, we got screwed, folks, and we're getting screwed again. And Obama, I'm sorry, folks, I voted for the son of a bitch, but Obama is a crook and a creep, and he's selling his country right down the drain. And, you know, I don't know. I thought he had something, but it turned out he has nothing. He's just another sick son of a bitch, like Bush was. And, you know, hopefully we can get rid of that bastard and impeach his ass, all right, before the 2012. Anyway, I'm gonna put on an interview here now that we had with Larry Dorman from the Ask Me Union. At Consul4.org in Connecticut, and we've had him on a number of times, and we're going to be talking about the little more local tonight, about the local elections of the statewide elections coming up, and the primaries that just happened, and the absurdity of that. So, you know, I hope you enjoy this. It's about half an hour. And we'll be back right after.
On things. We have kind of a spirit, we've had kind of a spirited race of things going on. So we had the primary and people were chosen, and so he's going to comment on that. So we're looking forward to hearing from him. And he'll maybe comment on some other things. I want to ask him to update us on what's going on with the Red Cross. He had come on and talked about that issue a couple of times, and I'm curious as to if anything was settled there or if those poor people are still suffering. Larry, are you with us?
I sure am.
Oh, good, Larry. It's nice to hear your voice. I understand you've been busy helping with some campaigns.
Well, last week I was supposed to, you were good enough to invite me on, and fortunately I think I was in the vortex of a losing campaign. But one of our labor-endorsed candidates was challenging an incumbent in the towns of Bloomfield and Windsor, and fortunately didn't prevail. But overall, I thought it was kind of an interesting day.
Well, good. Was he able to get out some of his message, I hope?
I think so. And, now it's funny. It seems like ages ago that there was a primary.
That was an incredible primary, wasn't it? I think they had a 20% turnout.
And you mean that
facetiously? Total turnout for the primary.
Yes, he means it facetiously.
No, that was real. It was only 20%.
Oh, I realize that.
Yeah.
It wasn't a great primary. I mean, that's what the problem was.
I think it tells you that where people are at with the two-party system here.
Yeah, people are feeling a little discouraged, and so many of the ads were so negative that turned off a lot of people.
Yeah, you wonder about the impact of that array of negative advertising.
Well, when you look at all you start looking at all the candidates, man, you realize how horrible they really all are. All right, and
it's a lot of mudslinging.
I mean, you know, the biggest ad, the biggest kick I got out of all the ads was the one, Schiff's ad against Linda McMahon. All right, where it showed the guy kicking, it showed Linda McMahon kicking the this guy, and the groin. Did you see that one? Yeah, you couldn't miss that. Schiff played that 1,000 times.
Why I'm laughing.
But I think that helped Schiff more than it helped McMahon more than it helped Schiff.
Look, part of the I hear from a lot of the experts and the insiders that that this drone of negative attack campaigning actually works and that it makes a difference to the candidates who succeed. And if that's the case, then, we're in a sad state. I will say that one case where it backfired completely, and I'm glad it did, was in the primary for state comptroller. Kevin Lembo is a good man. He's been the state health care advocate. I'm actually sorry to see him leave that position because he's been an advocate for consumers against the governor, against the big insurance companies, and he ran for comptroller. And Mike Jarjura, the mayor of Waterbury, the most corrupt town in Connecticut, ran a brutal, vicious campaign against Lembo that actually, by all accounts, raised Lembo's profile in a positive way and contributed to his victory. He gave Kevin Lembo more name recognition. And so there are occasional stories where this stuff backfires.
But all they had to do, the only thing that, what killed Jarjura, okay, to me, was that this clown hired Roland at $100,000 a year.
Good point.
That in itself would kill anybody. I mean, it was like I can't even imagine.
And when you think that he's running for a position that essentially puts him in charge of the state purse strings,
a bit scary.
Knowing that he's a fan and a friend of a disgraced governor who went to jail in the biggest scandal ever in Connecticut.
Yeah, and paying him $100,000 a year off the Waterbury coffers.
You would think you'd want to distance yourself from a person like that, but today.
I think that, and that's why I say, and maybe that you're right that it is sort of a unique case. I refuse to buy into this notion that negative advertising. I had a really interesting conversation, if I can just share with you. I was volunteering all day in the 15th Legislative District, and again, that's Windsor and Bloomfield, and a guy was riding his bike, actually. He was in training, and he owns a car dealership in the Bloomfield area.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked for a while, and he's actually a Republican. And he told me that he's angry with the Republicans, and he's written letters and so on to the Republican leadership in Connecticut, because he said that his business was starting to rebound and showing signs of a turnaround from when the bottom fell out. And he said when the negative campaigning starts, his car sales curtailed. And this guy owns a Volvo and Chevrolet dealership, in the greater Hartford area. Mm-hmm. So I found that fascinating. And he's angry that the Republicans in particular have turned up the volume on negative campaigning. And he said he's absolutely convinced that it affected his business.
Wow. Well, does that make him change parties?
I asked him that, and of course he said he's not ready to do that. But I appreciated that he shared that with me. I mean, what he was saying was that just when the economy shows any signs of rebounding, when people start buying things, that's always an indication of a little bit of an upturn or an uptick. And then all the negative campaigning starts, and people think that everything is going to hell in a handbasket again.
Yeah, well, that's terrible.
I think the worst that I saw was the one Foley, the one that who I forget who was running against.
Fidelli.
Yeah, who was it?
The Lieutenant Governor Fidelli.
Yeah, Fidelli ran against Foley, right?
Right.
And Foley. I'm not sure. It sounded like it was accurate, but according to that ad that they ran against Foley, he liquidated an entire
company
down there, and made $20 million from doing it. And his job, I mean, he was into acquisitions and mergers. That's how he made his money, I guess.
I actually appreciated that ad for no other reason than I think it'll be an issue going forward. This is a pal of George W. Bush's.
He, that's right.
He was hired by the Bush administration to oversee, and I'm quoting, the privatization of Iraq, and we can see how well that worked out.
Right.
He's a bad guy. He closed down a plant and benefited from it. He said it was a lie. He said it wasn't accurate, but he never provided the information to counter that claim. He's
a wealthy
Greenwich businessman,
right,
and
right.
As I say, a friend of Bush's. I think he would be dangerous for people of Connecticut if he were to become elected governor.
I'd be very scared to have him in any position of authority.
Lamont didn't look very good either, did he?
I was disappointed in how he looked.
Yeah, the Malloy's attack against Lamont was rather valid, I guess. And that he said Lamont was not the entrepreneurial genius that everybody
he betrayed himself to be,
I guess. And
was your take on that, Larry?
I happen to like Ned Lamont, and I think he's a good man. I'm appreciative of what he tried to do against Joe Lieberman, but I think that was his time and his place. And if Ned wanted to do some good for the state and for its citizens, I hope he'll take his considerable fortune and start a progressive think tank a progressive policy think tank. That would be the best thing he could do instead of running for office.
Do you think that suits his talents in a better way?
Yeah, that's my personal thought.
You know what bothered me a lot about his campaign, and I got to tell you, it's amazing that we were the first radio show to have him on when he was running against.
Hear that?
That was the first radio show you ever did. But the interesting thing was is that he just doesn't seem to come across very strong.
That spark that people need to have to be convincing.
Well, when you got $100 million, it's kind of like, it's not like the guy started from scratch. I mean, his family had hundreds of millions of dollars, one of the wealthiest families in the country.
Which is often the case.
He's not the only one in that position, Leo.
I think his
talents are better suited, as Larry has stated, maybe at a think tank. He's not, he's not the person that should be the face. I mean, he just doesn't seem to have that. But let's talk a little bit about Malloy.
Oh, there's one other.
I want to talk about Malloy.
I know, there's one other I wanted to mention, Rich, which I thought was a complete and utter joke, was this guy named Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, running for secretary.
What was he all about? I mean, you know, this is and that other one running for secretary of state, the mom. All right, what was her name?
Denise Merrill.
Denise Merrill. I mean, I'm a mom. You know that qualifies me. You know what I mean?
Well, she has been a state legislator and a leader, and that's a leader. You know, she's held a leadership position, and that's what Garcia. Yeah, Garcia was trying to ride that anti-incumbent wave, and then you're going to see a lot more of that
he was playing off the Jerry Garcia name, and you know, with the guitar and all this kind of stuff. And he looked like a complete idiot.
It was kind of it was a silly ad.
Complete idiot.
But anyway,
that was funny. This is a quick, funny, I hope funny story. I was at a bar with a union friend of mine from another union, having a burger and a beer one night. This was about 2 months ago, in a bar in Wallingford called Archie Moore's. And I met this guy for dinner, and we were sitting in the bar, and we were talking politics and talking about the different primaries. So we happened to. This gentleman was asking me about who's this Jerry Garcia guy? Does he have a chance against Merrill? And there was like a regular sitting next to us, and he turned around and said, "I don't mean to eavesdrop, but," he said, "I'm voting for Jerry Garcia. I love his music."
That's amazing.
That was the best line in a campaign that I heard. I'm thinking to myself, buddy, go back to your beer. Jerry's long gone.
Hey, how long has he been dead? About at least five years now.
But his ties live on.
Oh, his ties. I get one of his ties.
His ties live on. But let's just get a little more serious. Let's talk about Malloy and why you think he would be a good candidate and why he is.
Well, Dan Malloy, to me, we just attended the state AFL-CIO convention in Hartford, and both Malloy and Foley spoke.
And how did Dan come across?
Terrific. To me, Dan seems very gubernatorial. He kind of just cuts that leadership sort of figure. He is very frank, and he's very candid about the problems facing the state and its citizens. He doesn't run away from that. And the theme that he keeps sounding to our unions is that we need to have a partnership, and that I'm not going to promise you anything, but I am going to listen to you, and that you will be respected for the work and for the commitment that you show the state and that you show the cities and towns. And he is very focused on health care, particularly for kids, and he's very focused on education, particularly pre-kindergarten. He's done a very good job in Stanford, I think, as the mayor of Stanford, and we represent employees in Stanford, where even though he may not be, hasn't been a direct supervisor, but he's intervened to try and resolve some potentially ugly labor management problems, and that's, to me, the sign of a leader.
Mm-hmm.
He did it without fanfare. It wasn't stuff that ended up in the news media, but it was really designed to help improve labor relations. The other thing I want to say, Lila, to you is that I think would appeal to you, and then Leo, he comes from an interesting background. His mom was a school nurse.
Mm-hmm.
His sister actually started an AFSCME union, the president of an AFSCME quasi-governmental nursing unit in Stanford, and so he has a very strong appreciation for what union members do and for the commitment that they have to the services they provide. So
I got to ask you though, was there any truth to the fact that was that all covered up? It seemed covered up pretty quickly about I'm going to turn that over. I'll be just a second. Sorry. We'll begin again. No, big contractors for the
to
work on his house, kind of like what happened to Perez, you know.
Yeah, but it didn't stick, and you know that's he's been, you know, the thing is, I recall that those accusations first surfacing, or allegations, I should say, back in the late 90s, and they never gained much traction, and I think Lamont's people
picked up on it,
potted them out in the hopes of dragging Loy down, but I don't think there's anything there, and again, I can speak on and speak to and testify to is the fact that Malloy is a very even-handed, sure-footed person. He's managed a large city, cares about his employees. He has worked hard behind the scenes to have good relationships and to value the input of those employees. And you know, the fact that he has a sister who's a nurse and a union president, you know, he really has an appreciation for what the struggles that middle class people face. I think he'll be a refreshing change. And look, Connecticut's facing, by all estimates, a $3.5 billion deficit, and so he's not making any promises to anybody, and he's being very cautious and very guarded. But I think he's going to be the right kind of person to try and fix the mess that we're in. He won't be able to do it completely because this was created by the Wall Street bankers and insurance guys and all the bigwigs who are making out.
But quite frankly, you know, looking at the competition, I mean, looking at what's out there for him to run against, he stands a pretty good chance because there's nobody, on the Republican end that really doesn't look too strong.
And Foley looks like, again, the fact that Fidelli, who's sort of a non-entity, the current lieutenant governor under Rell, he's pretty much of a blank slate, a non-entity, and he was able to knock Foley down quite a few points heading into the final days of the Republican gubernatorial primary.
Yeah.
I just don't think Foley has what it takes, but I think he would be very dangerous if he were to get elected. And he, you know, he doesn't have Linda McMahon's fortune, but he's got a heck of a lot of money to play with, and that's always scary. You know, candidates can absolutely buy their way to a seat.
Larry, were you able to meet any members of Malloy's team and talk to them? Have you met them?
I haven't. I know a couple of people who have been with him for quite a long time and think very highly of him, but I don't, you know, I don't profess to be inside that campaign or to have a lot of working relationships. But what I will tell you, Lila, is that I've seen Dan speak to different AFSCME Council 4 affiliated unions. Several of our unions have invited him throughout the campaign to come speak, and I don't think he declined one invitation, and he really made a strong impression.
Good. You know, I gotta tell you quite honestly, after that the Stefano fiasco back in 06, we had him on the show here too, when he was running, and we, you know, DeStefano was a serious disappointment when he came out with that. Right after he lost the election there, he showed his true colors by declaring New Haven a sanctuary city and giving everybody green ID cards, you know, in the city. Remember that?
But now DeStefano wants to privatize our school custodians out of their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, this guy turned into a real...
I don't know what
piece of work. You know, you guys, weren't you guys backing him?
Now, yeah, and he also ran on the fact that he supported the union in education.
Yeah.
Yep.
Remember that? I remember.
He kind of turned his back on a lot of the constituencies that helped helped get him there, so including us. And you know, it was a spirited fight back in 2006. And you know, I'm not one of those people
look what
to look
he
back
done.
And say we goofed up or we picked the wrong guy. You make your choice and you try to do the best.
Right.
Things were set up this way for a reason, and maybe this time is Dan Malloy's time. We'll find out.
Yeah.
Well,
how about the great Richard Blumenthal here? You know,
he's gonna have a big fight.
He's in a major wrestling match.
He's got a knockdown, drag out, steel cage match.
Oh boy.
I think he's gonna
have some trouble, and I'll tell you why, because he's not really used to really running against anybody. He's always been a shoo-in. He's never had to speak really publicly. He's only had to say thank you very much, I accept the office, and swear to it.
Yeah, like Chris Dodd and Joe Lieberman. I mean, they're just complete shoo-in.
Yeah, I think he's going to.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's what concerns. Have you had him on the show recently?
No. No.
We got a grudge match.
I can't support him because of his position on the Scaticos. I feel very strongly on that.
And other issues as
and
well.
And other issues.
I certainly would hope. I'll obviously be voting for him. Linda McMahon scares the hell out of me.
Scares the hell out of me too.
Me too.
But I can't. But Richard Blumenthal, he surprised the hell out of me. Over the years, I really liked the guy back in the in 2000, 2002, or whatever, in 2000, even up to 2004. But this whole thing with the Scaticos, and then this thing with the line about the Vietnam War efforts, and God knows what other stuff that he's shown to be. There's a pettiness and a strangeness about this guy that's starting to emerge that I don't like. Linda McMahon, hey, you know what she's all about. There's no bull there. I mean, she's got $50 million she's throwing
into the
campaign.
And she's purchasing that office.
Yeah, and she's buying the office. I mean, I'm not voting for her, but I mean, a lot of people will. But I personally can't support anybody in this election for senator because I just think that Dodd was a crook. This guy's Blumenthal, I don't know where he's going to be at, but I don't like what he's doing. I don't like what he stands for anymore. And these wimpy little ads of his don't convince anybody that he's, have you seen his latest ads?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm such a sweet guy, to me, that just doesn't cut it. So, I don't know.
Interesting, because McMahon has clearly indicated that her campaign intends to continue going negative and trying to essentially smear Blumenthal's reputation and words. So it really is going to be one of those knockdown, drag-out fights.
It's
and I think Lila is absolutely a target. This is going to be about his capacity to actually prevail in a difficult campaign, which he admittedly has never had to do. But he doesn't like to lose, I can tell you that much. I think you'll see a different kind of person on the campaign trail. And I feel strongly about this race because of who McMahon is and what she represents. I don't want to see if the Senate turns into the hands of the conservative Republicans. I don't know what will happen with the Supreme Court and with other choices facing the Obama administration in his final 2 years. I just don't want to see that happen. I also happen to believe, and I appreciate and understand why you have issues with Blumenthal, but on the whole and on balance, what I've seen is a real strong record of taking on a lot of the corporations, and I think that he'll be a decent U.S. senator. I think he'll be a good U.S. senator. We'll see what happens, but you are going to see a fascinating match. That's all.
It's going to be pretty bloody.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think it's going to be pretty bloody.
I think what's important is that Blumenthal will have to come out. He can't play the nice little cradled boy, I'm so nice kind of guy. He's got to come out and start showing some colors here and show some fangs against a McCann.
Your opponent is prepared to spend up to $50 million of a personal fortune. You better figure out a way to.
But Blumenthal's no pauper either. He's got a whole lot of dough. His wife's family owns the Empire State Building, for crying out loud.
Yeah, that how they came into their money.
Yeah, they got tons of dough. So it's like, he's got to
part with his own
or tap his in-laws or something. But he's got to
Right.
He's got to do better than he's doing, man.
It's certainly going to be a fascinating fight to watch.
I don't mean to change the subject, but I wanted to ask what's happened with the Red Cross workers.
Appreciate your asking. We are in a holding pattern right now.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we have not resolved the issues that led to the three-day strike. And we were supposed to begin a trial with the National Labor Relations Board, which issued 5 complaints against the company for unsafe blood practices.
Right.
And four violations of our collective bargaining agreement that we feel would increase the potential for unsafe blood practices. So that was supposed to start in 2 weeks, actually, from less than 2 weeks from today on the 28th of August, and unfortunately the company got the NLRB to postpone, so we're not going to actually have that trial on those labor board charges until September. So our members are at work. We're just continuing to raise awareness and asking the public to contact the Red Cross. There's a link on our website, sign a blood safety petition, and continue holding the company accountable, and that's where we stand right now.
Good. And I also wanted to ask you a little bit about the article that you posted on Social Security. That's always a bit
surprising. You saw that.
Yes, I did. And what are your thoughts on that, Larry?
My thoughts on that are pretty simple. You're talking about an important, cherished, and successful program that the Republicans would love to privatize.
Yeah.
And I think that because we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of Social Security, it's really important time to remember that this system still works. The fact that it faces shortfalls isn't a reflection on the system itself. It's a reflection, obviously, on our elected officials who have allowed it to be in this state, to exist in a state where the Wall Street privateers want to take it out of the public hands and subject it to the whims of Wall Street. And just remember, these are the people who led us into the economic crisis. The last thing we need to do is turn Social Security, turn our retirements over. You know, most Americans, all they have is Social Security.
But the only thing is, and we can't forget this very, very serious fact, is that back in 1964, under Johnson, okay, what he did is he was able to use, he allowed the government to use the Social Security Trust Fund, all right,
to go into
the general fund. And ever since then, there have been, you know, everything that's left in that Social Security Fund is nothing more than an IOU.
There are a lot of problems you identified. You hit it on the head. You identified one of the problems, and that's what I meant when I said it's our elected officials who have allowed this to happen. They raided the Treasury, so to speak.
Well, you know, remember Gore and his lockbox?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, you know, that
seems like ancient history.
Doesn't it?
Another problem, quite frankly, with Social Security, and it's not the fault of the program itself.
Yeah.
The function of the times in which we live, the perilous times in which we live. Back in the 60s, you had something like 16 to 17 able-bodied workers paying into the system for every retiree.
Right.
In the early 2000s, that number was down to about 3 or 4 able-bodied workers.
Really?
The transformations that have overtaken our economy and have created low-paying jobs are also diminishing the system. You know, we have fewer people working decent full-time jobs, and that's in itself a cause for alarm, and it's also
not to mention all these jobs
on the system.
All these jobs being outsourced, and 10 million
right.
jobs being outsourced,
you got
two major wars.
Thanks to NAFTA and free trade
and
all the other trends that have happened, globalization, et cetera, et cetera. You've driven down the wages and you've destroyed the jobs millions of good-paying family-supporting jobs that paid into that system. So that, too, Social Security's ability to survive is directly tied to the jobs crisis. And the last thing I'll say, and I'll shut up, is that keep in mind that this system maxes out on payroll at $86,000. So those Wall Street tycoons that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, what is that? Why? I mean, with these guys that are getting the $100 million bonuses, I mean, if they paid 7.5% of that figure, I think we'd be pretty well liquid again.
They're paying 7.5% of $86,000.
Right, but if they paid it
in Social Security, somebody up in D.C. better show some guts and say, you know what, you got us in this mess on Wall Street, all you investment bankers and financiers, and you're going to help get us out of it by doing your part and paying your fair share. If you raise that ceiling just even a little bit, you're going to bring a necessary infusion of funds to protect Social Security. Still the best retirement program out there. It's funny, I see more of these crazy teabaggers and right-wing nut jobs who hate government collecting their Social Security check.
Yeah, they all do.
And Medicare, you know.
Yep.
Medicare.
Yep.
But you know the final thing I probably might want to bring up is that what Warren Buffett said. And he said that he was kind of ashamed in a way that his secretary paid more in taxes than he does.
I love to use that quote when I'm talking to my union members. You know, there are enlightened, wealthy people. He's one of them. You know, he said it's the millionaires and billionaires are waging a war on the rest of us, and the millionaires and billionaires are winning.
Oh, for real.
Well, he's right about that.
So anyway, we
But thank goodness we have people like you and Ask Me trying to look out for the rest of us. And
thank you, guys. I really value what you do. It's a public service. I wish we had more like you.
Well, thank you.
Keep the debate and the dissent going, and that's the most honorable thing you can do.
Well, good, and thank you very much. We do appreciate that, Larry.
All right, talk to you soon.
Yes,
right.
And keep us up to date on the Red Cross. I'm very interested in that.
Will do. I'll email Leo if there are any special developments between now and when I come on the show next. So,
good, we appreciate that. Thanks, Larry.
Right.
Have a good
Take
night.
Care.
Good Thanks. Night. That was Larry Dorman from the Ask Me Union, and we have a top of the...
That is WQQQ. One.
Okay, and... I want to thank everybody for listening. That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for Ask Me Union and then Connecticut. And, you know, join us tomorrow night when we will. Last Thursday, I kind of ventured off track, went into Facebook there and so on, but I don't know why. I just kind of like to do that once in a while. But tomorrow, I'm going to try to bring us back to the fourth dimension. And we'll discuss relevant topics there. So have a good evening, and